Welcome to Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. I am here today with Byron Edgington, the author of The Sky Behind Me, a memoir of flying and life. Welcome to Craft, Byron.
Thanks. Good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
This is a memoir, as I understand, of flying and life. So tell me about this book, how you got started on it. I know that you were a student at The Ohio State University in English.
In English. That's a true story. Yes, I just graduated. In fact, I may have been the only undergraduate on campus who was on Social Security.
Ah.
Be that as it may, I graduated in June of 2012 with a bachelor's in English. I had kind of a gap year. It took me about 40 years. So for those students out there who are struggling along and can't quite get it together to graduate, keep at it because eventually it will happen. Yes. But returning to the book, you asked why I got started on this project?
Well, I'm curious as to when you the timeline of when you started the book and if that lines up with the timeline of, say, getting a degree in English, which was it in creative writing or was it literature?
It was in English.
In English.
Yeah, your basic arts and sciences English degree. Okay. Yes, yes. It did kind of because it had been bouncing around inside my head for many years because I've had some success writing previous to that.
that sounds really like you're not wanting to admit it. You know, I had some, you know, I sold some, six million books.
I mean, but only 6 million. I don't like to brag about that.
What was the writing that you had done?
I've been published several times in trade magazines, once or twice in some national publications. In mostly in aviation, but in some related topics as well. And the story, the memoir itself, as I say, has been bounced around in my head for many years in one iteration or another. But once I got out of school, it took about 3 or 4 months to put it together and get it published. So, and of course, I mean, as everyone knows, memoir, the word memoir starts with me. So one of the reasons I wrote it was, well, as everyone else who writes a memoir, it's the quickest path to incredible wealth, of course, as everyone knows. But the real reason, now that we're back from fantasy world, the real reason was that I thought it was a good story. I thought people would enjoy reading about what I have done. I've had a marvelous life in this, in the sky, most of it. And in fulfillment of what a lot of nuns said when I was in grade school, that my head was in the clouds most of the time. They were right. But in any case, I've had a great life, and I had lots of very interesting, very engaging, fun, and interesting stories, and I thought people would enjoy reading them. And as it turns out, I've been right mostly. The book has been received very well.
Okay. You won an award for an excerpt of it that we talked about on Writer's Talk previously, and I think you had read one of the stories.
Yeah, I did. It was I won the Swedenborg Press is the oldest press in the United States. In fact, it was around in colonial times. And the Swedenborg folks offer, every year they offer what they call the Bailey Prize, and they offer it in nonfiction and fiction and in poetry. And my Bailey Prize award was given for part of the contents of the memoir. And I was awarded the Bailey Prize in 2012.
Okay. Now, I don't want to give away any of the secrets or the books or the surprises in the book, things like that, because there are a couple, there are several different times sort of surprise. There's some stuff that happens at the beginning of the book that I'm going to say really took me by surprise. So I don't want to take that away, but tell me about writing about some of the difficult parts of your life, some of the things that...
some of the challenges that...
Yeah.
Well, in fact, that's... You asked why I wrote it. That is actually one of the reasons that I decided to put the book together when I did, because it... we talk about lemons to lemonade stories. Mine is kind of a lemons into in-flight snacks stories, in a way, because I did have some challenges in my early teen years. And I had, I was, originally when I started out, I wanted to be a Catholic priest. And for one reason or another, including some abuse in a Catholic seminary when I was 14 years old, that dream of mine to become a priest was taken away from me. And I had to get past that challenge because it was all I wanted at the time. It was all I could focus on. And so not only was I dismissed from the seminary, but at the time I was dismissed, the war in Vietnam was taking every warm body they could that the Army could take. And men were being inducted right and left. And so in order to avoid that, and without any motivation or any real purpose at that time in my life, I had to find something to do to avoid the draft. And I wasn't successful in that. I went to Ohio State for a time, but my grades were, in fact, it's kind of interesting. My older brother once described my grades, my grade card as, he said it looked like May Day in Red Square. So yeah, he was absolutely right about that. But one thing led to another, and my student deferment went away because of my grades, and I got drafted in 1968, late 1968. And at that point, I was able to. I didn't choose flight school at all. It kind of chose me, and I was given the opportunity to go to helicopter flight school and took it. And I spent a year in flight school and then was sent to Vietnam. I went to Vietnam after that and spent a year in Vietnam.
You said you chose helicopters over airplanes. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, I was given a choice. At that time, the Army needed just dozens and dozens of helicopter pilots.
What made you choose a helicopter over an airplane? It seems like if you were going to have a malfunction, if you're going to have bad luck, say, you might have a little bit better luck surviving that in a plane than in a helicopter, which doesn't, like I think you say somewhere in the book, there's no such thing as a gliding helicopter.
No such thing as a gliding helicopter, to quote the late, great Harry Reasoner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, actually, there wasn't much choosing to be done, and I wasn't smart enough to make that choice anyway at that time, so... It was aviation, and I chose aviation rather than the alternative, which was the infantry, quite frankly. The choice was to either fly or to carry a weapon around on the ground in Vietnam, which had no appeal to me. Mm-hmm. And so that's the direction I went.
When you go through aviation school, something I've no familiarity with, tell me about the way that you're, in sort of general terms, trained on a helicopter, because it seems to me it's got to be very different than what we usually see with, say, TV and movies with, like, somebody can take over the controls of a plane, right? And they glide it safely which has always seemed to me absurd.
Yeah, but, not only in Hollywood, but yeah, you're right. We see that.
But nobody ever glides in a helicopter.
No. Well, the helicopter does have a feature called autorotation, which is kind of a whole different thing from gliding. But the initial learning curve is pretty steep. And there's a reason that they had flight school, the initial flight school in Texas, because it gave us quite a bit of room to learn in and not bump into things. So... But a helicopter is a very, very difficult machine to learn to fly because they won't fly themselves. If you let go of the controls of a helicopter, it will just find the fastest route to the ground. You know, that said, they're also not inherently dangerous once you know what you're doing. You know, and so, but learning to fly them is very difficult, and it was a real learning curve, at least initially.
Okay. So... When you're writing the memoir, what was, maybe it's the helicopter or stories, maybe it's being in Vietnam, maybe it's being some of the stuff that you did later, being a medevac pilot, I may not be calling medevac correctly, but a medical pilot. What are the stories that you said, like the first one, that's the one I want to write down because that's the one that's most vivid to me?
Yeah.
And is that how this progressed?
Actually, it is. That was kind of the driving force The central part of that Vietnam story, which comes out in the book, is in reference to a mission that I took in Vietnam that had nothing to do with the war itself. It was to rescue a pregnant girl in Vietnam, a Vietnamese woman. Mm-hmm. And the short version of the story is that she was in labor. The baby was breech, and there was a big storm coming in right at the same time that I was asked to go get her. And she lived in a little village down just north of Da Nang called Vien Mai. And I had worked for a group all day long and was released from them to go back to home base. In fact, I was told, I was ordered by the commanding general of the division to be on the ground no later than 5 o'clock that night because of the storm. And when I received this new mission to go rescue that girl, it was going to take me till at least 5:30 or 6 o'clock to accomplish that mission and get back home. And so I had to weigh the possibilities. I was under a direct order from a commanding general to get home. And at the same time, I had this young woman who needed the helicopter and needed to get to a hospital. And I consulted with my crew, and we decided together that the thing to do was to disregard the general's order and go get this young woman, and we did. And we went down and got her, and the storm had come ashore at that point. But I managed to get her to a hospital finally and dropped her off. And we went home, and I confronted the general and ironed things out with him. And
it seems to me that you're maybe skipping a little bit.
Well,
there.
Yeah, there's parts of that that I'm not telling. Yeah. But I managed to keep my wings in the process, which was no small feat. Yeah, he was not pleased until I told him exactly what the details were. And then, of course, it was, you know, you do what you have to do. But it wasn't until about a year and a half later that I found the upshot of that story, the ending to that story, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. And without giving away too much, I found out that that young woman had done very well that night. And the little field hospital that I dropped her off, or where I had dropped her off, the doctor at that hospital was a fellow named Stuart Roberts. And little did I know that a year and a half later, I would end up flying with Dr. Stu Roberts right here in Ohio on a program called the Medicopter. And that was, it was the, basically the first air medical evacuation helicopter in the state of Ohio, run by the military at that time. And anyway, it's a very interesting story, and it pushed me to write this memoir because of that particular story and a few others like it. But that one was the one that was kind of the impulse to get the thing down on paper.
Now, you've also got a number of stories in the book about being a medical helicopter, I think mostly in Iowa City, mm-hmm. for 20 years.
Years at the University of Iowa hospitals in Iowa City, yeah.
That's a job that seems to me that you're going out to pick up people that are sometimes sick, sometimes can't make it to the hospital, that, you know, may not be really a traumatic thing, but you're also going to a lot of traumatic accidents, and you describe some of the accidents in the book, and that seems to me like a career that might have a lot of people leaving. Because you're so, it's kind of like being medical personnel at the scene. Well, it is being medical personnel at the scenes of a lot of sort of gruesome highway accidents.
Sure.
And you describe one specifically that made you ill, I think, or something like that. And so, you know, did you have those moments where you thought, you know, this is a career I'm doing the flying, but there's a cost to it that may be more of a psychological cost than I really want to incur? Is that something that happens to medical helicopter pilots, or they're far enough away?
I think we're able to keep it at arm's length for the most part, partly because you have to, and partly too because of the kind of people that are attracted to that business, I believe.
How would you define those people?
Well, just as an example myself, it was my initial impulse, my initial thought for a life purpose was to help people in any way I could. That was my default position as a kid growing up. And so the air medical, in some ways, it was almost like a replacement for the dream that I had lost initially. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it that way. And the air medical, the 20 years I spent in Iowa City, was far and away the most gratifying work that I had ever done. And it was when we're able to help people with the skills that we have acquired and skills that we're actually the best of ourselves, you know, that's a good life. And I was very good at what I did. I was highly compensated for it and got a lot of perks for it, you know, which may or may not have mattered to me because I enjoyed doing what I was doing. And I'm one of those people that never worked a day in my life because I just so enjoyed what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that comes out in the book. I think it does.
Well, now, there was also a time that you spent in my hometown of Toledo, Ohio.
Mm.
That doesn't sound necessarily like...
Ah, yes, Toledo, Ohio, yes.
Yeah. Right at the same time that I lived in Toledo, Ohio,
although I
never I took a helicopter ride. I don't think in my life, but certainly not a medical helicopter ride. So I read through it and I said, oh, well, this wasn't the best experience for you in Toledo, but that may be part and parcel of being part of Toledo, which...
No, Toledo was one of those teachable moments, let's say. Yeah.
Oh, my degree is from the University of Toledo,
so I think I
have some license to make that. But an endeavor in Toledo, Ohio that didn't work out. But a much more successful one was in Alaska, it seems to me, where you had talked about Texas as a place where you wouldn't bump into anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking originally, well, it's to do the size of Texas, but also it's a lot of it's flat. I think, and I think that's what you had in mind. But in Alaska, that's not the case.
It's not the case.
You describe it as really beautiful with a lot of scenery that nobody else ever gets to see because it's too inaccessible.
Yeah. So, Alaska is in fact, I think I even wrote this in the book that it's a place where you never quite fully come back from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just so rugged and so pristine, a lot of it. That it's just, I mean, everybody should see it, but I don't recommend spending a winter there. Yeah. So,
is it colder than Columbus, Ohio in the winter? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I wasn't going to say that. You know, okay. I'm sure that some folks might take that from, but it's pretty chilly up there. And just for example, in fact, I think I wrote about this story in the book. I got into a snowstorm in Alaska just before I left Alaska on August 28th.
That's
so
right.
That give you any indication of it all of what it's like.
It's a 10-week growing period.
Yes. Fortunately, they have sunshine about 20 hours a day during that 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's where you get these tomatoes the size of smart cars. Yeah.
And did you bring those back with you to Ohio?
Well, you know, they wouldn't let me carry them on the airplane. Otherwise, I would have.
That's too bad. Now that you've got the book done, now that you've got the memoir done, what's the next thing that you're thinking about working on? Mm-hmm. You're going to have to go out and be a race car driver in order to get more.
You know, something boring like that.
More stories for your next book.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to follow up. I do have two or three things that I'm working on, one of which is another memoir. It's titled Growing Up Crowded, about being the second pup in an Irish Catholic litter of 10. Yeah. So,
how well does that phraseology go over
we'll find out.
You haven't delivered that description to them yet.
No, in fact, I'm very careful. Never tell people that you're writing about that you're doing that until the book is published.
Okay.
You know, that's my personal philosophy.
Well, you've made a grievous error here.
Yeah, probably.
Because this is, I don't know if you knew, but it's being recorded.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah.
So,
you should have told me sooner.
Yeah.
But I'm working on Growing Up Crowded, and it's coming along pretty nicely, I'd say. I also have a couple of novels in progress, one of which, thanks for letting me plug these, Doug. I appreciate this.
Oh, that's why you're giving me this $100 bill right now.
That's right. Better check that.
I think the ink seems to be coming off. Yeah.
Yeah. The novel is, it's kind of, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the novel Matterhorn by a fellow named Carl Marlantes. I'll give him a plug. Matterhorn is about Marines in Vietnam. So my book is called Wailing for Willie Pete, and it's a cross between Matterhorn and Moby Dick, if you can envision that.
Okay.
It's about a fellow who is, in fact, a warrant officer, pilot in an aviation company in Vietnam, and his commanding officer is a madman. a fellow who was injured in a previous encounter with a North Vietnamese colonel. And that colonel is this fellow's Moby Dick. And he's going to go after him and he's going to find him, even if it means taking out his whole company with him. Okay. So Matterhorn meets Moby Dick.
Okay. Yeah. And that'll be released when we'll put you on the spot here. How many weeks do you have left of writing?
I guess there's that small detail of finishing it first.
Right.
Aside from that, I would hope that that one would be out and available for my millions of readers, mm-hmm. hopefully by the end of next year.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, Byron Edgington, author of The Sky Behind Me, A Memoir of Flying and Life. Thank you very much for talking to me today on Craft.
Certainly. Thanks again for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.